took the air down by Blackwater side. 'Twas in gazing all around me, 'twas the Irish lad I spied. All through the first part of the night, how we did sport and play. Then this young man arose, and he gathered his clothes, saying, "Fare thee well, my dear." That's not the promise that you gave to me when first you lay on my bed. You could make me believe with your lying tongue that the sun rose in the west. Go home to your father's house. Go home and weep your fill, and think on your own misfortune brought by your wanton will. One morning fair I took the air down by Blackwater side. 'Twas in gazing all around me, 'twas the Irish lad I
Mother, make Ahem. We did finish up with music from Miriam Gendron right there from 2024's May Day. That was Long Way Home. Linda Thompson performing that old standard Blackwater side with Graham Taylor on guitar, performing live in 1983 on television. Kei Yoshimatsu from Zentai, the collected works of him. 1847, the track we heard, and before that, Afterwardness doing 24/7 from Ding Dong. My name's Scott, and I look forward to seeing you next week, friends, right here at the Freeform radio station you love so well, WFMU in East Orange, WFMU, MFU in Mount Hope in New York City, and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. I'll see you next week. Stay tuned. Tectonic is on.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst, I will be your host for the next hour. Such a pleasure to have you here with me. We're going to be speaking with a live in-studio guest today. I'm so happy to welcome to the show Noah McCormack, who is the publisher of The Baffler. And you're going to hear all about The Baffler and why I'm so excited to be speaking with Noah today on Tectonic. First, let's say hi. Noah, are you with us?
I'm here with you.
Thanks. Thanks for coming out to the station to talk.
My pleasure.
Let's talk first about The Baffler, because we are going to be getting to an essay that you wrote in the November 2025 issue, which we'll get to. But in addition to having written a piece for the November issue, you're also the publisher of The Baffler. So tell us a little bit about The Baffler, where it came from, what it does, and what you do as publisher.
Sure. The Baffler was founded in 1988 as a magazine of cultural, political, social criticism by Tom Frank and some of his friends. Tom Frank is probably best known for his book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And, you know, The Baffler was interested in sort of deconstructing American society as it was presented, you know, in, you know, the conventional media and common wisdom. And so, you know, it early issues focused on things like, what are the suburbs really about? You know, what, why are people so invested in the internet? You know, a famous early article was about sort of the techno-utopianism of Wired magazine and what was that really about? You know, it published essays on, you know, literature, you know, journalism, music, and you know, it was, you know, the 90s were not a great period for the left in this country, you know, possibly the worst decade for the left post-war. And, you know, The Baffler was a sort of a beacon of brightness on the left during that time. And, you know, in I think 1998, a lot of the best essays were collected in a book called Commodify Your Dissent, which is taken from a famous Tom Frank essay called Why Johnny Can't Dissent, which is about how, you know, the corporate advertising had figured out how to co-opt all forms of cultural dissent. You know, and that was a surprise bestseller, kind of put The Baffler on the map. Then in 2001, The Baffler offices, which also stored all the back issues and everything, burned down. There was no insurance, and, you know, the guys, and they were all guys who had founded the original Baffler, were sort of going on to the next stage of their career, you know, writing books, getting jobs as book editors, such and such. And so from 2001 until 2011, I think there were three issues published during that time.
Wow.
And post-financial crisis, some people from the old Baffler and some new people who'd never been involved, you know, relaunched the magazine, feeling like the moment had come for its voice to be necessary again. And that was in 2011. I got involved in late 2012, early 2013, and worked there for a few years. And then in 2015, I became publisher. So I've been doing this for a little over 10 years now. And so, you know, I'm in charge of all the non-editorial operations at the magazine. You know, we have an editor-in-chief who does all the content, a great guy named Matthew Shen Goodman, who's an amazing editor, and the editors who work, you know, with him. And, you know, I've fundraising, you know, the operations, all of that is under my purview.
And you wrote some pieces years ago, but you haven't written a piece until the November 2025 issue.
Yeah, you know, I go through phases where I really want to write stuff, and then I get focused on sort of my day job of operations, right, and then it comes back to me. And this piece,
well, let me set it up. Actually, before we get to your piece, I should also say, as we're talking about The Baffler, that a past guest is one of your contributing editors, Liz Pelley, who wrote the book Mood Machine on Spotify. She was on the show not that long ago. And Mood Machine is a great book. Anybody who wants to understand how Spotify works. And I believe we talked about some of her baffler pieces in that interview.
Yeah, I mean, Liz is a great example to me of sort of what we're trying to do at The Baffler. You know, we published some of her early pieces about Spotify and the algorithm. You know, that got her some attention. I don't want to say we got her book deal, but, you know, along with some other things she wrote, it helped her get a book deal, and then that had cultural influence. So, you know, it's a great example of, you know, how The Baffler is trying to, you know, inject leftist ideas into public discourse.
Okay, so you're publisher of The Baffler, and by the way, the website is thebaffler.com. I've put a link to that on the episode page, which people can get to at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And as I said, in addition to being publisher, you wrote an essay in the November 2025 issue. The essay is called, "We Used to Read Things in This Country," and there's a link also to the essay on the episode page. In this essay, you're describing the rise of literacy starting, let's say, about 1,000 years ago in the feudal age, and then the decline due to TV and then, of course, the internet. And we'll get to all of that, especially the role of technology, the internet, the addictive slot machines people carrying around in that decline of literacy. But let's just talk for a minute about reading and writing. You know, the literate culture, as you write about in the essay, came after a culture of orality, that is, the spoken word and images. What does literacy make possible that orality does not?
Yeah, so, you know, in the essay I drew on a number of scholars for this, but most prominently Walter Ong, who was a Jesuit scholar who dedicated his life to exploring these issues. And, you know, what Ong says, and I think this is correct, is that, you know, the oral cultural world is inherently conservative. It's small. It's what you know. It's based on memory as the organizing principle. It's tied to what he calls the human life world. You know, the rhythms of agricultural life, the weather, births, deaths, marriages. It is an aggregation of what is already known, and is dispositionally suited to believe in supernatural explanations and what we might call the irrational.
Right. Okay, so we have Walter Ong, who, as he says, a 20th century Jesuit priest, writing about the transition from an oral society, knowledge and culture spreading via spoken word, to a literate society, which is the printed word. And then Ong says, and you're pointing this out in the essay, when television took hold in the 20th century, Ong diagnosed that society was going through what he called a second orality. What did he mean by that?
Yeah, so Ong was talking, you know, that television brought back many of the communication methods of the oral age. You know, television is also reliant on, you know, the memory of the audience. It's not suited to sort of long analytic thinking. It's visual. Oral culture was heavily visual. And so he called it secondary orality, that the television age had returned a lot of mass communication to orality, but it was different from the first orality because it was on top of a base of literacy, you know, that, you know, newscasters read the New York Times to inform their newscast, and, you know, people writing, TV shows read novels to inform their plots and everything. And sort of one of the things I'm arguing in the article is that what Ong couldn't see due to the time he was living in was that, you know, technology would advance even further with, you know, short-form video and AI, and, secondary orality would become something much more like primary orality.
Right. So we now in the age of AI, generative AI, and social media being flooded by generative AI, There's a lot of outcomes of that, which we'll get to in a minute. But now we've established Walter Ong having diagnosed the shift from oral to literate culture and some sort of a return. But I appreciated that in your writing of this essay in The Baffler, you're layering in the concept of power and its importance in what sort of culture is taking place. So, for example, you're writing about in the feudal age, like I said, let's say about 1,000 years ago, only the landed aristocracy, only the nobility really knew how to read. You write, reading at that time was a form of power, which is why the nobility increasingly wanted it for themselves. No landlord would want his peasantry to read or even see the reason why they would want to. So here, you're laying the groundwork for a very important idea that you developed throughout this piece, that to quote one of the posters I probably saw in elementary school, reading is power.
Reading is power. And, I'm a Marxist, so, this essay was generated, by my interest in, how does class and literacy interact both in the past, but also in the present moment, we're living in. And, before I worked at The Baffler in a previous life, I went to graduate school for a degree in European history. And, I knew that, public education, both in Europe and America and elsewhere, came about because employers, needed a literate workforce. They needed them to be able to read manuals about how the machines worked. The military needed, literate soldiers, so that they could, understand battlefield tactics and communicate. And quite famously, after the Soviets, launched Sputnik, the first satellite, America invested, vast sums in both secondary and tertiary education. We had to be able to do science better than the Soviets. And I was interested in the question as to why was this suddenly no longer true?
Right. And even before Sputnik, you're writing about what you call the high point of mass literate culture. I think you're talking about in the U.S., not in the USSR. Was the period roughly spanning 1890 to 1914?
Yeah, in both Western Europe and the U.S., this was sort of the high point of literate culture. You had this was the great age of the newspaper, which had been enabled by the telegraph. People were reading on a scale never before seen. The working class, which had been taught to read in school, then formed their own, working men's clubs to read books. The everyman's library sold cheap books that people could read. Something I was struck by many years ago reading this great book called The Great War in Modern Memory by this amazing literary scholar named Paul Fussell is that, the number one object owned by common British soldiers in the trenches of World War I was the Oxford Book of English Verse.
Right.
And that, when they were, being shelled and terrified for their lives, they flipped and read poems by John Donne. And this was partly, the effect of education and partly the effect that, electronic communications had not been invented yet. And reading was the mass media of the time.
Although you point out that Aldous Huxley, interestingly enough, was against the universal education that provided this mass literacy. He said, this is a quote by Aldous Huxley, "Universal education has created an immense class of what I may call the new stupid."
Yeah, elite Europeans sort of across the political spectrum, from sort of socialist curious people like Huxley to right wing people like Nietzsche, you know, were very upset because literary culture had been the preserve of the highly educated.
Right.
And it was elite, and it was shared among the elite. It was an elite signifier, and suddenly, you know, literacy was being shared by the common people who were reading all sorts of things that they regarded as unsuitable. They didn't like newspapers, which they thought catered to people's base instincts. You know, you can sort of, you know, if you know about, you know, British tabloids like the Daily Mail, you can sort of imagine what they were upset about. You know, they didn't, you know, they didn't like the sort of cheap popular romance novels that were the most popular form of fiction. They did not like that. And so, you know, one of the things I talk about in the essay is that, you know, modernist literature was in many ways a reaction to this. That if you,
right.
you have to create this new form of highly abstruse, intellectualized writing that is, again, inaccessible to most people.
Right. So at first, we were the only ones who could read, and the peasants couldn't read, and so we could publish whatever we wanted. But then universal education came, taught all the peasants how to read, and now the factory workers how to read. And so now we need another preserve just for the elites. And so you quote an author named John Carey writing that modernist literature was created as a form of elite expression that would be impenetrable to the newly literate masses. I was surprised to hear that. So would that include something like Ulysses?
Ulysses, T.S. Eliot, Virginia Woolf, you know, these were all things that you could not appreciate without a substantial amount of intellectual background.
Right, but I let me just ask about this, because I'm reading Ulysses right now as part of a larger reading program that I can tell you about some other time. But Joyce, no one went to Joyce and said, hey, could you obscure this thing up a little bit? It's a little too straightforward. How did it happen that, you know, or were the elites promoting Wolfe and Joyce? What was the effect of the elites' interest on those authors?
You know, the effect was, I wouldn't say it was like a conspiracy or anything. It was more just that they were naturally drawn to new experimental forms that were had cachet in, you know, the groups that they traveled among and knew. And so, and you know, modernist literature is very, you know, I'm not at all saying that modernist literature is, you know, not interesting. Virginia Woolf is one of my favorite writers. You know, they're highly intellectualized forms of writing that require, you know, a substantial amount of knowledge not present on the page,
for sure,
to understand and comprehend. So it was a sort of it was a way to recreate the elite reader and their closed circle in an age of mass literacy.
And you know, I can identify that with that myself. I had to have a companion volume explaining what each chapter in Ulysses is actually talking about, because on my first read, I'm finding it quite challenging, but rewarding. Anyway, so let's move on to media as it developed after modernist literature. So you talk about the rise of popular radio, and then of course the introduction of TV, and then you mention President Kennedy's FCC chair Newton Minow, who famously said that TV was a vast wasteland. And I guess you know Newton Minow was immortalized in Gilligan's Island. The SS Minow was named after him. So they said, oh, it's a vast wasteland, is it? And so they named the boat after Minow. So then we've got newspapers who are starting to decline. So TV is ascending. Newspapers start to decline, especially with the introduction of the internet. And now, at this point, you said newspapers are at a point where most of them now just depend on older readers.
Yeah, I mean, most newspaper readers are over the age of 60. So, you know, at At last count, which was 2024, there were 1,033 daily newspapers left in the U.S. You know, that's basically half of what it was at the high point. And, probably half of those are going to disappear in the next, you know, probably 10 to 20 years as their, readership, dies off. Warren Buffett, bought a bunch of newspapers. And, the idea was they'll have great revenue streams for the 20 years they're around, and then, they won't be there anymore.
Yeah.
And, I talk about in the article all the things that happen when the newspapers close. You know, corruption increases in local governments. The cost of borrowing money by cities increases because they're borrowing more recklessly because it's not being covered. There's less community events. People feel more atomized. You know, what we call political polarization increases. There are a slew of documented negative effects when there's no longer a daily newspaper in your locality.
All right, so this is an important point, and you did go into some detail about this, the importance of newspapers in the civic life, in the democratic fabric. And again, I'd bring it back to an analysis or an issue of power, because as the newspaper declines, the citizens collectively have less power. And the centralized power, whether it's in the city or in the investors, now the technocrats who seem to be running things, their power increases.
Their power increases. I didn't quite have room to talk about this in my article, but most of the people who owned these local newspapers were the local wealthy business elite. These newspapers were conservative. JFK said, he never would have been elected president if TV hadn't come around, because he could take his message directly to the American people and bypass all the local, conservative newspapers. The flip side of that is, like, when Barack Obama ran for president in 2008, before the newspaper collapse had really accelerated, he could go to, like, a small town in Iowa, sit down with the guy who owned the newspaper. They could chat. That guy's probably not going to endorse him, but he is going to run an editorial saying, I had a really thoughtful conversation with Barack Obama, who is not a Muslim, terrorist or whatever. And, I use this line at a different point in the article, but it's sort of central to a lot of my thought. Things can always get worse. Like, it is true that most of these newspapers were owned by, local conservatives, but the conservatism that they represented, compared to, what has replaced it is relatively benign by comparison.
If you're just tuning in, by the way, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. And we have a live in-studio guest today, Noah McCormack, who is the publisher of The Baffler. I've got a link to The Baffler on the episode page and a link to Noah's November 2025 essay called "We Used to Read Things in This Country." All of that is on the Tectonic website at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And as the title of the piece suggests, we're talking about the importance of reading in this country and other countries, as opposed to a culture of orality, or let's say just image. And I think image here is where I'd like to take this next, because you brought up before a minute ago these short form videos. So we have newspapers declining, and all of the power that is aggregated by citizens by the existence of a newspaper and by their ability to read about what's happening in their community, all of that is going away. And what is filling the void is social media that is largely short video driven at this point, and increasingly, as we've talked on this show, is being flooded by just rivers of sludge, also known as generative AI, that comes out of the big tech companies. Talk to me, Noah, about this shift. What happens when a community or a country or a whole society gives up reading? I'm hyperbolizing a little bit, but gives up reading and adopts short form big tech generated videos instead.
you know, reading is a thinking medium. Like, you know, when you're reading, the longer the, you know, what you're reading, but anything that you're reading is sort of continually reteaching you how to think. It's prompting new thoughts and new connections. The written word is analytic. It encourages thought and connections between different ideas. And, you know, short form video is basically, you know, the opposite of all of that. You know, if Newton Minow thought that a 24-minute show was really stupid and bad, I mean, a 90-second...
24-second, I was going to say.
Yeah. You know, generative AI thing would have, you know, killed him on the spot. You know, one of the quotes I draw in on the article is, you know, Umberto Eco, the Italian social theorist and novelist, you know, most famous for his novel Name of the Rose, which was made into a great movie with...
Anthony Hopkins, no?
Anthony Hopkins and Sean Connery. But he was also a great social writer and historian theorist. And, you know, he makes his point that there was this, you know, priest intellectual in the 13th century, Robert Grosseteste, and that, you know, he wrote this treatise on optics. And, you know, part of the treatise on optics was this extended analysis of, like, what is the difference between hallucination and sight? Because, you know, it's probably over-exaggerated, like, you know, you kind of have to be when you're writing stuff like this. But, you know, for much of the Middle Ages, miracles, hallucinations, what you were actually seeing, these were all sort of fungible categories. And, you know, Grosseteste was like, here, you know, is a way to tell if what you're seeing is actually real and in front of you. And, you know, Eco says that this is, you know, the beginning of the passage into modernity from the Middle Ages. And, you know, watching people gleefully embrace AI video content and, you know, there's this one going around right now, which is apparently very popular with, you know, boomers on Facebook and other people, where these, you know, grotesquely... inhumanly large, you know, prisoners are chained up in court like they're in a, you know, Christopher Nolan Batman movie with the Bane mask on, and, you know, the judge sentences them to 28,000 years in jail for all their crimes, and they pull on their straps and they're like, take this off and say that again, and it's the same script over and over with just slightly different visuals. And you know, I was reading the comments where people are like, thank God, you know, these people are locked up and whatever. And it's like, we have regressed back beyond right. This 13th century advance.
So people are seeing these so-called hallucinations and treating them as real phenomena. I mean, I remember when Gen AI was just starting to flood into the internet, and I had Jason Kebler on from 404 Media, and they covered this quite a bit, the Shrimp Jesus meme. For some reason, this image of Jesus made out of shrimp went viral. And as you say, there were 10,000 permutations of it, all slightly different, but basically the same idea. But I don't think anyone really thought that it was real. I'll put it that way. However, now we see Gen AI getting a little more, you know, photorealistic in its depictions, and people, you know, they don't, if this is their connection to the community, you know, there's no newspaper and there's less civic participation and so on, then you can see how some people would look at that courtroom slop and think it was real.
Yeah, there's the people who think it's the real, and then there's the people who don't care if it's real or not. Like, a sort of side obsession of mine is hippopotamuses. For some reason, I'm just very fascinated by this animal, you know, which kills more people than any mammal other than human beings, along with a lot of other interesting things, like that they are whales' closest relatives and can have a underwater language that we're only just beginning to understand. But, you know, for 15, 20 years, I've been in, you know, Facebook groups, you know, Reddit groups about hippopotamuses, and, you know, it was all real stuff. And, you know, in the last year, I look at them so much less because people generate these fake AI-generated videos of hippos doing things, and it's just like there's so much real – there's so many real hippopotamuses in the world. Like there's this incredible town in South Africa called St. Lucia where the hippos just wander through town. Like you're going to get gas, and there'll just be a hippo wandering through the gas station.
Wow.
And it's like – to me, that is so much more interesting – than AI generating some stupid hippopotamus. But there are apparently vast numbers of people who prefer, you know, this completely, to them, controllable AI world to the real world that exists outside and is uncontrollable.
But that's a pattern, isn't it? It's not just, I mean, certainly accurate what you're saying, but I would broaden it to beyond slop on social media, you know, some of these AI bots that people are forming quote unquote relationships with, and there's a problem of sycophancy that whatever the person says that they intend to do, even if it involves self-harm or harming someone else, the AI bot says, oh, yes, yes, that's a great idea. You're brilliant.
No, it's a real problem. I mean, you know, the dating stuff is sort of like, what consequences this is going to have. But, you know, as you probably have read, the great, tech journalist Kashmir Hill has had a, series of articles, yeah. In the New York Times about how, this is driving people to suicide. You yeah. know, they start spending all their time with these chatbots that tell them whatever they say is true. And they'll be like, I think I've uncovered, a conspiracy, the aliens that landed at Roswell are, doing X, Y, and Z, and, they're going to get me. And that it's like, the AI chatbot is like, you're totally right. You've uncovered what no one else has uncovered.
Yeah, and some people are coming to science journals and saying, an AI chatbot told me that I've uncovered a new law of physics, and I want to share it with you. It's all forms of, I think, Kashmir Hill talked about this in her stories, that there's something now called AI-induced psychosis. People are literally being driven crazy by these interactions. So here we have a new low. Like you said, it can always get worse. We thought that Shrimp Jesus was bad, and now look where we have descended in just a year or two after that. So all of this, if we, again, put this in context, where first, we had a culture of orality, and then the elites learned how to read, and then there was mass literacy, and then TV came along, and then the internet, and then social media, and then generative AI. And now we're at this point where it's hallucinations and image and video, all fake, that is detaching people from their connection with reality. Fair?
Yes, definitely.
And if that's our arc and that's where we are right now, Noah, then I want to bring it back again to what I saw as your underlying thread throughout this essay, which was power. And I want to read a quote from the story that I thought really summed it up well and brought up an important question I want to dive into. Here's what you write. AI has given the American ruling class, and let me just stop there, the American ruling class, according to this show, is big tech and their investors and their senior executives. It is now big tech and their financiers and their government partners. But the power in this country is now centered on big tech. Let me go back to your quote. AI has given the American ruling class the final impetus to more or less abolish education. The elites are ecstatic about imagining a vast, uneducated, and unproductive population forced to pay companies like OpenAI to access the written word and to approximate thought. With the unemployed, illiterate, and addicted to screens, they are unlikely to be politicized and join a socialist campaign. And you finish with, I thought, a great summation, the final sentence of the essay. This is the world Sam Altman and Mark Zuckerberg want you to live in, so that their power cannot be resisted. And I thought that was so good. It echoes what I've said for years on this show, that the battle ahead, in my opinion, is not so much about the traditional split between left and right as we used to understand it. The battle instead is big tech versus the rest of us. And you're painting a picture, a pretty grim picture, but it is pretty persuasive that there is an advantage to the big tech elite for these systems to be foisted on the American public and beyond, so that they have less power.
Yeah, returning to my earlier point that like the elite pursued mass literacy because they needed educated workers and educated soldiers. You know, what we call Gen AI, but I don't really think it's an artificial intelligence. You know, we may or may not ever be able to reach true AI, but large language models will never be able to get there. You know, as you know, they're essentially just very advanced autocompletes. But they have invested huge amounts of both money and psychic belief in them. And what they believe is that, you know, soldiers don't need to be literate. They'll be wearing, an Anduril, you know, the Peter Thiel-backed, war tech startup. You know, they'll be wearing an Anduril headset that will tell them what to do on the battlefield. So it won't matter if they're literate or illiterate. And factory workers won't need to be literate to read the manual on how to operate the machine, because a robot powered by AI will do that. And, you know, OpenAI has entered into, you know, these billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of contracts, possibly even trillions, I'd have to check. You know, they need $500 billion in investment just to make it through the next couple years. And it's like nothing can provide the return on capital that they have invested other than a situation in which basically every person in America and the developed world is paying $30 or $50 a month to OpenAI when they need to produce or understand something that's written down.
That's right.
It's about there's a quote in the article by an executive who's like, yeah, I'm using AI to fire people. AI never asks for a raise or goes on strike. And that's sort of the dream that they have here, is that, you know, they will have for the first time, you know, since maybe before the Black Death, a completely controllable and docile, workforce, so to speak. And, the sort of dystopian vision you find in movies of, from WALL-E on, you know, that people are just, you know, sedated and watching entertainment and given drugs, is essentially their vision of how most people live their lives, and, you know, explains a lot of the Silicon Valley interest in, you know, universal basic income.
And ironically, when you talk about people sedated and addicted to entertainment, it makes me think of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World.
Yes.
Aldous Huxley, who was against universal education.
Yes. A man of contradictions.
Yes. Do I contradict myself? Yeah.
I think there's been a long debate. Did Orwell's 1984, did Aldous Huxley's Brand New World, you know, predict the world we're living in? But, you know, we're living in sort of a combination of Huxley's world, Orwell's world, and, Bradbury's world in Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, where Bradbury was wrong was he imagined that we would need this, like, secret police that would go around burning everyone's books. But it turns out that if you provide them with videos of
hippopotamuses.
Apparently a really growth genre on Facebook is videos of dogs rescuing children who have fallen in bodies of water. If you provide people with enough videos like that, they'll just stop buying books on their own.
Now, you did counter this in a way by saying people are still reading, not to the degree that they were, but there are some genres, and I'm using that word intentionally, genre fiction, that are doing okay. And you point out this new-ish genre called romance fantasy, that seems to be selling some books. But you make the point that your concern is not so much the quantity of what's being read, it's more the quality.
Yeah. I've always enjoyed a good romance book here and there. You know, it's not, I don't look down on the genre, but, you know, what has happened that has made me read a lot less romance books is that they have been tropified. These tropes like, the masculine dominant hockey player or, stuff like that. People don't write books around characters or plot or storyline. They write them to fit in as many tropes as possible because that's how the books are sold and advertised. And so they're almost like...
it's sort of like the Spotify... Sorry to interrupt. It's like the Spotify effect.
It is. It's exactly
like that.
Liz Pelley
wrote about in Mood Machine that actually is beginning to use AI to create tracks that the computer thinks is going to make them popular.
Yeah, and AI romance books are popping up and they're selling too. And, there have been some okay romanticy books, but, I think as a... as an expression of like real, a human being actually sitting down and writing things,
yeah.
It's getting further and further away from that. Because even when a human being's doing it, they're writing it to fit in as many tropes as possible because that's how the books are sold on TikTok and stuff.
All right, so Noah McCormack, publisher of The Baffler. You're the author of this essay in the November 2025 issue of The Baffler. We used to read things in this country. There's a link to the Baffler site. There's a link to that essay at tectonic.fm. What should we be doing individually and collectively? And I'll just fill in the first thing. We should all be reading the Baffler. I got it. But apart from reading the Baffler, what else should we be doing?
Individually, I just encourage everyone to read as much as possible. I mean, I struggle with this too. I do read less than I used to, especially book-length things. I use TikTok. I try not to, but we're all struggling with it. But collectively, we need to regulate and possibly eliminate the current forms of social media and AI. I mean, there is really nothing. Social media might have some socially beneficial effects, but, unregulated social media that is optimized around just producing as much engagement as possible has clearly been societally destructive. And, as far as I'm concerned, the benefits of AI are so small compared to the negative costs. And it's just, it's incredible. And I write in the article about how, if you survey, like 30 different countries around the world, the U.S. is like the second or third least optimistic country about AI. Only like 30% of Americans think it's going to improve their life. In China, it's like 90% of people think it's going to improve their life. And it's because in China, it's being used to like make tractors that don't need humans to operate them so that they can grow more food. And, the government heavily regulates them from producing, slop videos. Kids under 18 can only do that for, 1 hour a night.
Video games.
Or scrolling.
Oh, really? Doom scrolling as well?
Doom scrolling as well between 8 and 9. Obviously, this is evaded a lot, but, people in China correctly believe that, their communist government will restrain, the tech companies from, destroying civilization. And, people in America correctly understand that our elites are in the pocket of tech and will not do this.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I was imagining, 90% of Chinese survey respondents said X. And I thought, well, did they know that someone was going to be watching what they said to the survey? I would love to have regulation in the U.S., without an authoritarian government surveillance state that has been installed. I'd like to go back to what we had, to some extent wasn't perfect in the post-war period where there was a social safety net in this country. Unions were allowed and even encouraged. People read. There was some degree of civic participation. It seems like on all of those aspects, we have regressed.
I would agree. We have regressed because powerful people in this country, got together. On the left, it's, this document called the Powell Memorandum, written by future Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell in 1971, has become sort of totemic. He laid out at when he was working at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, you know, a whole strategy to, you know, he was like, you know, consumer rights, unions, these are all, you know, ascendant. The left dominates the academy. You know, we need to use our money, which we have the most of, to fight back. And, you know, it's been largely successful. You know, they have achieved their goals of sort of rolling back. And, you know, 1971, the year the memo was written, is the year that, you know, wage gains and productivity gains separated and have never, you know, come back together, which is, you know, why no one can afford anything anymore.
I just, the image that anytime the talk goes to where the tech elite and their government partners are taking us, the image that comes to mind, speaking of an image-driven culture, is that photo of the inauguration from early 2025 of the current occupant. And standing right behind the podium were all the CEOs of the big tech companies, signaling by their physical presence there that this was their new alignment. And, you know, more recently, they all chipped in to help pay for the destruction of the East Wing of the White House. And who knows what else is going on for them to cement that partnership.
Yes. You know, they are our enemies. Their power must be broken. And, you know, that is one of the great political tasks of our time, is to bring capital back under the control of the state rather than let the state be completely controlled by capital.
All right. There's just one last thing I want to bring up, Noah. This is a fun item. It's a little bit of a geek out, and I hope the listeners will permit me to geek out with you for the remaining couple of minutes before we got to close. You were talking earlier about Anduril. I think that's Palmer Luckey's company,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right.
Teal-funded defense contractor, high-tech, you know, drones, and what did you say, like, digital soldier suits, AI-enabled?
Like headsets, headset. You know, to tell you what to do.
Right. So you painted this picture, which is quite compelling. A soldier in a future war is maybe has not been given proper training in a boot camp or a war college or something, but it's okay because the headset that he or she is wearing is giving instructions from the AI. So there's a voice in their head saying, turn left here, shoot the gun there, you know, say this to your squad mates and so on. And I'm thinking, where have I heard that kind of that setup before, where there's a voice in someone's head giving them instructions, so they're practically an automaton? This, in 1979, was the premise of a book, a strange and wonderful book by Julian Jaynes, who was a Princeton professor for a long time. It was called The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. And Walter Ong, in his book, Orality and Literacy, talked about Julian Jaynes because Jaynes wrote about, back in the Homeric days of the Iliad, that maybe the Homeric heroes were listening to gods speaking in their ear. So here, it brings us full circle that maybe what the tech elite are building for us are headsets to get messages whispered into our ear from the new god, which is their AI.
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to these people talk, it is very clear that an AI-based religion is on, you know, their roadmap for how this is going to go. You know, the people will be worshiping the AI like as a god. You know, if you know, Joe Rogan is almost there when he talks about, you know, how amazing AI is. And so, you know, possibly within the next couple of years, definitely within 10 years, we're going to see, you know, an American religion emerging around the AI god, for
All right.
Sure.
And so the best way to resist this is what? What's something we can do to set up our resistance of that new religion?
You know, support politicians who, you know, are willing to confront this head on, you know, politicians who support antitrust, politicians who support socialism, you know, to the extent possible, don't subsume your life into these tech, you know, matrices, and, you know, continue engaging with the written word.
Okay, so what should we read? Give us a book pick or two. What's one of your favorite books that you did manage to get through this year?
One of my favorite books that I did manage to get. I read a great spy novel about a woman spy, sort of riffing on the classic Le Carré novels by a woman named Leah Carpenter. I really enjoyed that. That was great. It's called Ilium. And another book I read.
Another Iliad reference.
Really loved was, the new Thomas Pynchon book. I'm a huge fan of Thomas Pynchon. I think, he understands a lot about this stuff.
Sure.
And his new book is a lot of fun.
Bleeding Edge, did you like that one?
Yeah, I did.
What's your favorite Pynchon?
Gravity's Rainbow.
Yeah, yeah. I started it. I haven't gotten through the whole thing. I have been on a Greek and Roman kick this year, and so I actually did read the Iliad and Odyssey and Aeneid, and at some point I'm going to do at least part of a show on that reading, and part of that was reading the Julian Jaynes book, which if anyone is really in for a mind bender, I would recommend it. It's a classic book. It's called The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, and it goes to some pretty wild places. And now in Ulysses, for obvious reasons to continue the Homeric Jeopardy category, I guess. So Noah McCormack, I want to thank you for being here. We're all going to be visiting The Baffler at thebaffler.com. Anything in particular we should look for there?
Well, the subscribe button, it's a great magazine. Afterwards, the issue my essay appeared in is still the current one out. Our next issue goes to press on Wednesday, so 2 days from now. It'll be out, at the beginning of the new year. We do 5 issues a year, and those are all themed, and then we publish nonfiction and fiction online. Our fiction comes out on Fridays online, our nonfiction the rest of the week. And, we cover pretty much everything that's bad in the world.
Oh, what a wonderful mandate. Anything that's bad. I'm surprised it's not 1,000 pages every time it comes out.
My mother is like, "Are you sure you want to work at Depression, the magazine?" And I'm like, it's important. I do want to work here.
Well, some people say that this radio show is depressing sometimes. But, it's like penicillin. You need a little bit of the bad in order to shield you from.
I'm gonna borrow that line. I'm going to borrow that
yeah,
line.
Yeah, all right. Well, Noah McCormack, publisher of The Baffler, really appreciate you coming out to be the live in-studio guest today. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Pleasure talking to you as well. Thank you for having me.
Again, that's Noah McCormack from The Baffler. He has a piece in the November 2025 issue, the current issue of The Baffler, called "We Used to Read Things in This Country." You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City, Rockland County at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. I want you to stay tuned for Dave Mandel. I can't handle Dave Mandel, and neither can you, but you can handle Mandel's It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show, and he's going to take good care of all of you. Until next time, friends, I do have a little bit of homework for you. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. For our outro, thanks to Brother Daniel Blumen, I've got a piece by Patrick Cowley called Robot Children. Do you love your... I'll see you next time, friends. Have a good one.
Hello, how are you all tonight? I am fine. My name is Dave Mandel. This show is called It's Complicated. It comes to you every Monday evening at 7, hot on the heels of the Tectonic program, hosted by Mark Hurst. Welcome. Thanks for joining me tonight. Lots of good music, believe it or not. And we're going to start with a band I have played on this show, but not in a while, not in a couple of years. So, you know, the statute of limitations is up. And they are one of the, for my money, one of the great, one of the greatest of the Italian prog bands, kind of borderline. This band was a member of Rock in Opposition, RIO, who I mentioned probably very often on the show, the organization of mostly European groups assembled, organization founded by Chris Cutler of Henry Cow. And they are very good. Stormy Six is the band I'm talking about. And we're going to hear a track from a 1980 LP called Macchina Macaronica, Stormy Six.
Infanzia è appena ieri, l'assenza era sotto i bicchieri scolati sul marmo, il richiamo formicola ancora nel grano, le lucciole, presenze intermittenti tra i monumenti e i mari e gli sterrati. Nell'atrio della casa popolare si può seppellire o studiare, per rabbia lo puoi pregare, intatto.
imperfetto. Quasi niente.